Claims Act from a situation in which the state merely waives its immunity from tort claims that already exist by virtue of statutory or common law and turns the Tort Claims Act into an act that actually affirmatively creates a new cause of action. And I think that's fairly well exemplified by the response to the Smith versus School District case, where this legislature had created a certain set of procedures by statute, but the Court of Appeals found there was not a judicial remedy for it. And so in this case, what we have is a broadly stated statutory provision for a cause of action that may turn many statutes that now have no judicial remedy to back them up into a cause of action that is sufficient to get a plaintiff into court. So at this stage, we do know that there's going to be an expansion of the number of theories by which an individual can seek judicial relief. We also know that with respect to the claims that would be filed anyway, your common law tort claims, we can see within those new complaints additional theories for relief that we have not seen at this time. So,
time out. Some powers are even more stronger than us. We have a call, and hopefully we'll be back in about 15 or 20 minutes. So if you could have a cup of coffee and enjoy the ventilation in this room, we'll be back. We're temporarily recessed. Let's see. I'm trying to think where we were. Oh, we had asked a 25% question. That's right.
Yeah. The magic state agency number.
Right.
Mr. Chairman, Bill Nestle again. At the time of the call, I was explaining why we believe that 25% with in fiscal, an increase of 25% in fiscal impact was reasonable. I had indicated that this bill creates a new cause of action.
I'm assuming that you're operating off the, and this fiscal impact represents the amended version.
That is correct.
Okay, good.
And it is our primary concern with this new cause of action. As you can see from reading the Smith case, I think that gives you a primary example of what may occur. In that case, there was an attempt to enforce a statute that was not enacted with an intent to benefit discrete individuals, but merely stated a general duty on behalf of the school districts in favor of the public in general that they were to adhere to in administering their programs. The attempt here is to turn that statute into one that forms the basis for a cause of action. And if that school district case is to be used as an example, I think you may be able to perceive where such general statements of legislative policy as a board of county road commissioners shall repair and administer the highways, if it states affirmative duties like that, may arguably be pleaded as a tort cause of action. At that point, we have congeries of new potential causes of action, novel theories that have not been seen by public defense attorneys that are going to be fleshed out by plaintiff's attorneys that haven't seen them, and which are ultimately going to require a considerable amount of appellate litigation in order to get final authoritative guidance on the interpretation of this clause as it applies to these other statutes. So not only do we perceive that there's going to be a substantial increase in the number of cases filed, but also a significant increase in the number of theories or claims for relief within the pleadings in those cases, and also very heightened appellate activity as a result. And given this cumulative effect until the fallout has been determined, I think that in the next two biennia we can see some very substantial increases in our litigation costs and commensurately in the claim costs. Another important aspect is our prison litigation. The individuals out at the penitentiary that seem extremely fond of filing writs and actions against their incarcerators in general. In numbers of cases, I would assume that with respect to our appellate litigation, that probably constitutes 25% of our appeals to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. we are virtually certain that once information with respect to this new cause of action is disseminated in the prison system, we're going to see a new theory based on this statute pleaded in virtually every prisoner case. So I don't think that 25% is an unreasonable response to this. And I think that once we get fully into the appeals that are going to be involved in the next biennium out, it may even be a little bit conservative with respect to that second biennium.
Representative Burton?
Mr. Nestle, did you testify on this bill originally?
I have not given verbal testimony on the bill, Representative. I had prepared on behalf of the Department of Justice, I believe it was 7 pages of written testimony on the original version.
That's the one that's dated May 14th?
That is correct.
And is it the position of the Department of Justice that the bill is unwarranted then?
Yes, this is a... It was more so... Yeah, our primary concern now is the creation of the new cause of action. The question with respect to judicial immunity still remains in the bill as it has been amended. I think that all that is significant that has been eliminated at this point is the claim for attorney fees.
But the new cause for action remains in the amendments that were proposed, which is the concern you had, the main concern you had in the first place.
That is correct.
The information that you're providing, well, you're not providing this, but that we're being provided with on the fiscal impact that impacts your department is not, that's right here in front of me, it was not anticipated in the governor's budget.
That is correct.
And I'm wondering here if this bill were to pass a subsequent referral of Ways and Means as a result of this.
Maybe.
Is that safe to assume? Or
no.
Not safe to assume. Then let me ask this specific question. I'm not sure who should. In the additional legal expense that's indicated here of $630,000, which would increase to $693,000 in 87-89, is the expense to the state to various departments based on the anticipated 25% increase in
That claims. Is what that is based on.
That's your hourly charges back to the.
That is correct. However, this application, of course, is limited to the liability fund because at this time, some of these causes of action that perhaps otherwise would be enforceable exclusively by remedies such as mandamus or writs of review now arguably are defined as torts. And therefore, by virtue of that definition, it becomes an expense of the liability fund rather than the individual state agency that would otherwise defend itself.
Are there any further questions? Mr. Nestle, I did hear you say earlier, I guess you do agree then that there are statutes out there that do not provide a remedy.
That is correct.
Okay. And why don't we see if Mr. Danielson wants to say anything at this point? Representative Springer?
I sense that Mr. Nestle wanted to maybe complete a statement, and I'd like to just have that.
Sorry, why don't we do that first?
I'm sorry, what I intended to point out was the fact that many of those merely state a general duty that a public official has to the public in general. It does not constitute a statement of legislative policy to provide a particular protection for discrete individuals, but rather it states standards of general conduct. And what we fear is that with this new amendment, it will turn these standards of general conduct, enforceable perhaps under a taxpayer suit or so forth, into a tort claim for relief.
Representative Buck.
Question on that. When you say there's no remedy, in many of those that are general policy for the good of the citizens, aren't there often mandamus or other remedies available in those cases?
That is correct, Representative. There's a body of law that recognizes an individual standing merely as a taxpayer of the state, for example, to enjoin an unlawful expenditure of public funds. And along that lines, there is, of course, a judicial remedy. But that remedy doesn't result in relief that is designed to compensate or protect a particular individual.
Did you have any other comments on the fiscal impact or the bill itself?
Chairman, Representative Burton asked a question, I think, regarding the cost of the state agencies. I might comment just briefly on that. The budget that the Ways and Means Committee has approved for the Department of General Services includes a premium charge state agencies based on the existing Tort Claims Act. We have, at the present time, about a $3 million deficit in the liability fund when we compare assets to liabilities at this point. This additional expense that we're looking at in this fiscal impact statement must be charged to state agencies or else we're going to fall deeper behind in our deficit.
You have a 2 or 4 year plan to make up that?
Yeah, we have we actually have about a 10 year payout on the deficit, and we're pretty much on target right now. So in other words, to keep on that target, we would need to go to Ways and Means and get a subsequent appropriation limitation in order to get the charge of state agencies to keep the fund on that track of amortization of the deficit.
On the other hand, since you don't have any experience rating, true experience rating on this action, you don't necessarily have to go to Ways and Means. You can wait till you start to get some experience and you can go to the e-board if there's a need for any money, because I think Mr. Nestle did address what we'll call substantive suits, and as well as what we should also call frivolous suits.
Well, that's true. That would be the way it would work in practice, but we need to reserve for these claims immediately. We need to start reserving on a pro rata basis. So if we're looking at $3 million that we're going to have, and let's say 75-80% of that's claims, we would immediately have to start reserving 1/24th of that each month, beginning with the July biennium. See, we're assuming that this money will be paid in, earning interest in, and be available then to pay claims 3 or 4 or 5 years down in the future when they come due. So,
but you don't have any claims.
No, but we would start having claims on the effective date. And at that time, we would have to start reserving. We carry at this time what's called an incurred but not reported reserve. It's a statistical reserve based on our claims, the delay between the time of an occurrence and the time it's actually reported to us. And that's mathematically calculated by actuaries. So we would need to add to that as we start providing this coverage to state agencies. That's our prudent management approach to it.
But I can't recall if it was 79 or 81 that risk management developed in terms of
1981.
Mm-hmm. And are you adjusting already? Maybe you're changing your experience ratings with different agencies. Would that be fair to say?
Yes, that's right. Each agency has their own experience modifier, and they pay a higher or lower premium based on their loss experience compared to the state average.
And it's like new insurance, and then until you get true experience, you're going to be in a state of flux, probably for the next 10 years generally.
Well, if we do it that way, we're going to get in the same trap we did in 1975 when we went into the tort claims program and the liability fund, and that's we just put enough money in to pay claims. And what happened is that there was not reserves established for those future claims, future legal expenses. And one of the first things we did when we started the risk management division was start reserving for those future claims so that we have the money available to pay those. And so if we say we're not going to collect premium for that exposure that starts on the effective date, we're going right back to the same philosophy we used when we started. And we're just going right back down in the hole again. Because sometime you're going to have to put the money in.
But is Mr. Snyder, isn't that a difference between a self-insurance and a true insurance pool? In 75, it was a dollar-for-dollar self-insurance type program, and now we're trying to establish more of a true insurance program for the state.
Well, the self-insurance, it means you keep the funds within the state and the investment income and all that is kept in the state instead of going off to a commercial insurance company.
No, I mean in the sense of, how do I want to say this, more of a dollar-for-dollar approach.
Yes, to the extent our expenses are less in the private sector, then the claims dollars are, we pay our claims as they occur. But we need the money in the fund to pay them when they occur. And that's the point I'm making, that we need to accrue some reserves for these future claims in order to keep going on a fiscal basis.
And I guess my point is that your 25% figure, your $3 million figure, it could be grossly low, it could be grossly high. It is just a guess at this point because there is no experience out there whatsoever.
we would still reserve for the increased exposure in the fund. We would take approximately 1/24 of the claims we would expect, which is the $1 million.
But see, that's my point. That's the guess. I mean, well, that's what it gets down
well,
to. It gets down to a guess.
It's a recognized exposure, and it's a recognized a frequency increase in claims, and I think a prudent manager would have to recognize that. I know an insurance company would. They would charge more money for the policy for this.
I'm not disputing that.
Yeah.
The fact that there would be some more money required, it's how much, 1/24 of what is the issue. The of what is what's at issue. If, you know, if the state is experiences either through, because of the fact there's a lot of frivolous suits out there, or because the state is obeying the law, and that, you know, suits are brought and people are going to be, the state's going to be liable for disobeying the law, then there's going to be claims paid out. It's going to cost money. Our hope, of course, is that the state's going to obey the law. We won't have to pay out the monies, at least in terms of those. You know, we can't control necessarily the frivolous suits until we get the appellate court type decisions, which would draw the framework in terms of eliminating a lot of the frivolous suits.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's correct. What we'll see initially is litigation expense more than we will claims dollars. We would, as I say, increase our reserves about 1/24 of the $3 million each month during the biennium. And after our experience develops in this area, then certainly we would lower our premiums. If that, we might have to go the other way too, we don't know really. But it's our best guess at what lies out ahead with this bill.
Mm-hmm. Okay, further questions, Representative Burke?
Yeah, Mr. Nestle, in Maine versus that particular case where the Supreme Court, I believe, stated that the application of 42 U.S. Code created a was too broad of an application in the case of constitutional rights, and therefore began a series of. In fact, I think Oregon was involved in some of those cases. Began to look under what the underlying statutory law was pertaining to that, to the application of that U.S. code.
Yes.
And I'm wondering here, what we're really trying to examine in a sense was the intent of the legislature in a sense when it sets up the laws based on those remedies, what the intent was to whether or not to make that tort or not. What we're doing here, I gather, is applying a tort concept to all of those laws, whether the intent of the legislature was to do that or not. And would it be fair to say the Supreme Court really has, in that particular case, tried to find a way to get beneath the broad application of 42 U.S. Code to solve that same problem? And answer that question. I have a follow-up question to that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think that's a very accurate statement of what has occurred under those cases. They have basically ignored the wording of the Federal Civil Rights Act and gone back and looked at the legislative histories of the particular statutes which the parties tried to enforce in court. I've had some personal experience that indicates how far that type of litigation has reached. In the Gypsy Moth case a couple of years ago, there was a special statute that indicated that the labeling and use of pesticides would be regulated by the Attorney General and the Environmental Protection Agency, and the parties tried to claim that that created a civil rights cause of action in their favor. We prevailed on that issue, but it is reaching a bit, and it was seriously made legal contention. That's the type of thing that we fear we're going to have to flesh out, that type of situation.
Other questions? Thank you. Mr. Danielson, do you have any comments?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Danielson. I reside at 8995 Southwest Rambler in Portland. Represent the Oregon Education Association and speaking for the bill. I would make a very brief comment concerning the fiscal report to begin with. And that is, when we introduced the bill, we were well aware that our citizens that are damaged because of failure of public officials to comply with the law, and that is the reason that we introduced the bill in the first place. Obviously, if there is no damage caused as a failure to comply with certain statutes, then there is no claims liability. I think that some of the arguments that are used, and I think it's wise to look at this from a non-judicial point of view momentarily, and look at it from the standpoint of the expectations of the general public. And I think historically this country has been viewed that this is a country of laws, and of course the courts are designed to interpret the laws. And I think that it would be very difficult for the average citizen to be told that my city council has grossly violated state law, and as a result of that, I am damaged, clearly damaged. But as a result of the fact that the law does not have a specific enforcement applied to it, that I am not entitled to damages as a result of that violation. And that is, in effect, the argument that has been used. I think in the amendments that we have submitted to you, that we have answered all of the specific legal questions that were dealt with in the hearings that were held previously. We have dropped the attorney's fees, we have dropped the punitive damages, we have dropped prospective damages, we have made a lot of changes, and I think what the bottom line comes down to is it is pure and simply this, and that is that if you allow people in the general public who are damaged to collect as a result of violations of state law, or remedies, or specific remedies do not exist, then it's going to cost more money. And I don't think that that has been the intent. I have been here when many of these laws were enacted. And I don't think for a minute that many of these laws, and I can't speak for all of them, obviously, I work in a relatively narrow field, but I don't think for a minute that legislators sitting before committees enact these laws with the idea that if it is convenient to follow them, then the public body should, and that if somebody is damaged as a result of the public body not adhering to those statutes, that there should not be, in fact, damages awarded. I think that is probably what almost every legislator in this body thinks. And I recognize that in legal jargon that may not be the way it turns out. In fact, we know that it is not the way it turns out. Now, when they talk about an extension of the number of suits, it is quite true there may be an extension of the number of suits. It is also quite true that you will see a decline in certain types of suit that you might call of an experimental nature, or you're probing to see if there is, in fact, a method to get at certain violations, or you bring something under federal law when you might well have brought it under the state constitution or under state law. I think some of you that are attorneys are well aware that even where there is no remedy listed, that you may find some remote section of federal law or some remote section of the federal constitution, and you in fact may bring suit. And suit is not something that is reserved for being right. You can bring suit without being right, and it is done every day. And this, in fact, would design clear remedy, and I think that is in the best interests of the legal profession, as well as the state of Oregon, as well as public agencies across the state. I don't think they have any idea what the additional costs would be. Certainly there would be some, and certainly it would be in the realm of possible for the state or for the various municipal corporations to handle that. We are well aware of municipal corporations that have had great difficulty sometimes with the claims that have come against them for violations, particularly federal violations, to be very blunt about it, and for their failure to comply. We have seen malicious violations of law, and unfortunately they happen more often than they should. So it is our view that the only argument that has justifiably been raised against this particular legislative proposal is the argument that it costs money. And I think the strongest argument for this legislative proposal, and again putting it in very simplistic terms, is that if a person is damaged because a public body refuses or does not comply with the law, and that particular person or individual or group, whatever the case may be, should in fact be able to recover damages. That is the simple and only reason for this particular bill. Now, we had heard questions in the first hearing that the matter of attorney's fees made this a bill that trial lawyers could not look at without drooling, and perhaps that was true. We did, in fact, remove that particular provision, and that in itself, according to many, will reduce the number of cases that will be brought under this kind of a provision. We heard about the matter of punitive damages, perhaps making this excessive remedy for the kinds of statutes that we're dealing with. So we removed the punitive damages. We talked about prospective relief, and we removed prospective relief as one of the elements in this particular bill. And I think as we look around through the various provisions here, we rewrote the operative definition of tort, and which means essentially that what had to happen is that the people had to be operating in their official capacity prior to the time that a violation took place. We believe that this comes very close to paralleling the requirements as it relate to federal statutes and federal constitution, and we can think of no logical reason why the same protection should not be afforded for the state constitution and for state law. I think the same arguments can be made against enforcement of federal provisions as can be made against the enforcement of state provisions. I don't think there's any question about it. And again, it all comes down to the fact if a citizen is damaged and if the legislature had failed the remedy under the statute at the time the statute was adopted, then in fact should that citizen be entitled to recovery? And it is our view that they indeed should be. And if the legislature does not intend for recovery, then of course perhaps that should be stated in the action.
Representative Bunn.
John, you indicated, you talked about gross violations of state law by governmental bodies, and that the only reason that had been given for not passing this bill was the cost. Let me give you a scenario that I think is a realistic scenario and ask your reaction. You've got a small city government, and I'll say without apology, I've represented small city governments, and I think I understand their problems. They have a police officer, a police chief, and they have a contract with that officer, and they find that that officer is drinking on the job. So they have a series of five hearings so that they protect all of his rights, giving the full hearing process. He then, after dismissal for cause, has the right to file an unemployment claim and loses that, has the right to file a workman's compensation claim and loses that, has the right to file a contract action, chooses not to bring that because he feels he would lose, perhaps. Then you have the situation of a choice of a federal or a state remedy that the city knows is going to cost them $20,000 to $40,000 in litigation costs, and the party who suggests they were wrong says, I'll settle with you for $20,000 to $30,000. Now, they've got a choice of spending that in court and maybe losing or winning, or paying it to that party, that man or woman, as a settlement. That is a reality under the federal act now, in addition to the reality that you stated. And I'm wondering if we really want to impose that on our cities and counties that are already burdened with substantial financial costs.
Well, Representative Bunn, I am not going to pretend that justice prevails in every legal action that is accomplished in this or any other state. But my experience would be in looking at laws that enforceable laws tend to cause a better conduct of activity on the part of the governing boards of municipal corporations. Let me be specific. Prior to 1973, we did not have a Fair Dismissal Act, and we had all kinds of horrendous examples of where people were dismissed in pure violation of rights. And of course, today, even without a dismissal act, many of these would have been we could have filed litigation on a whole variety of grounds on many of these situations. In 1973, we adopted the Fair Dismissal Act, which was a rather rigid standard. And of course, the debates went on about the tremendous amount of cost that would be associated. This is a specific remedy, so it would not be affected by this statute, I might add. But at any rate, the tremendous cost. You might even have been around when this was going on.
I supported that bill.
At any rate, the net effect has been that we have fewer than 20 cases on average in a year, most years fewer than 10, and that most of these things are worked out in a rather rational manner. And the reason that that happens is because the municipal corporations are aware that there is a remedy, and as the reason for that, they know there's a remedy. They know if they are in strong violation of law that they are going to be found out. And so it is the presence of the law rather than the law itself that causes a better code of conduct among those members of the municipal corporation boards. And I think you would see the same thing, that in cases, there are many cases that are litigated today that are litigated when the governing board members know they're in violation of the law. They probably also are fairly aware that not much is going to happen if they do violate the law. But if they are aware that there is a cause of action available, then I think you're going to see some of those things avoided before they ever start, and before the citizens are ever damaged in the first place, which I think should be all of our intent as we deal with legislation.
Just very, very briefly, and I appreciate the comment and response, John. I think the Fair Dismissal Act is a specific remedy that was badly needed that we passed and had a positive result. This, to me, is a broad umbrella that has a different effect than that. I just comment on that.
Certainly, I'm not pretending the effect is the same, but I think the theory is applicable.
Any more questions, Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Been wrestling with this.